to Three Professors Walk Into the Bar. This is our second episode, and today we're focusing on health, disease, and climate change. Today we have three phenomenal professors from the campus working with us, Professor Anderko, Professor Wessel, and Professor Ropi. So I'm going to have each of you just go around and tell us a little bit about yourself, what your background is, and what you do on campus. Professor Ropi, if you'd like to start.
So I'm a professor of chemistry on the main campus, and professor of biochemistry and molecular biology on the medical campus. So I have a good-sized research laboratory that's basically spread out across the two campuses, and most of my lab members are graduate students, PhD students in either chemistry or biochemistry program in infectious, we have a PhD in global infectious diseases, the biochemistry, biotechnology program, we have some students from that program and so on. So it's a real mixture of different people with different backgrounds and different interests, but we're mostly focused on trying to understand drug resistance phenomena of one sort or another. And our biggest project right now is on antimalarial drug resistance, which gets us interested in a number of issues pertaining to the biology of malarial parasites. And as you probably know, they get transmitted by mosquitoes. So we tend to start dabbling in a whole bunch of different topics. I guess that's why I wound up here because the vector biology, as we call it, is so important to understanding disease and disease transmission. So the lab studies a whole bunch of different things. And we use tools of chemistry as well as biochemistry and molecular biology.
So I am a professor at the School of Nursing and Health Studies. I also hold an endowed chair in values-based healthcare and am director of the Children's Environmental Health, the Mid-Atlantic Center for Children's Health and the Environment, which is funded through CDC and EPA. I think also relevant to this conversation is in 2013, I was awarded the Champion of Change for my work in public health and climate change by President Obama. I do a lot of work these days in climate and health. I've done research specifically looking at climate changes, heat, air quality, and admissions to hospitals, particularly around kids, related to asthma and allergies. And I'm happy to be here.
And I'm Lois Wessel. I'm a family nurse practitioner, graduate of Georgetown's family nurse practitioner program at the School of Nursing and Health Studies. So I teach in our program, which is a online master's degree. So we have students from all across the country, which is interesting from environmental perspectives when we hear about things going on. We've had students who couldn't come to class because of tornadoes and floods, people in Houston, people in Miami recently. So we've seen the impact on climate change on some of our students. And one of the unique things we do in our program is we actually visit the students in their sites so we can see what some of the environmental problems are. We can see how healthcare is being delivered, and we can also see some promising solutions. And in addition to that, I work with Laura at the Mid-Atlantic Center for Children's Health and the Environment, where we field questions from people in the community. They can be parents, they can be patients, they can be providers, they can be researchers who have a question about a lead exposure. Recently we had a question about arsenic. We've had lots of questions related to asthma. And I also work clinically in a federally qualified health center, which means a health center that gets money from the federal government to see low-income people. I speak Spanish, and most of my patient population are Spanish-speaking, although not exclusively. And I think that it's important to point out that with any of these environmental problems, it's often the poorest who live in the worst neighborhoods and are getting affected. I think asthma and lead are two of those that we can point to. So on these code red days in the summer, we see kids coming in with acute exacerbations of asthma. We see refugee families who are coming from some of these countries. We've heard of, certainly we're going to see a lot of people from Puerto Rico because legally they can come here, whereas some of the Central Americans, there are other issues with immigration. And so I see firsthand as a frontline clinician what some of these effects of climate are doing to the low-income population in our own community in D.C.
So, incredible group. We talked a little bit before we got started here just about where we wanted to take this episode and where we wanted to go with it. Professor Anderko brought up some really kind of tangible, happening right now situations. which is what we always love to talk about here, is what's happening right now and how that relates to us. Mm-hmm. So if you maybe want to get us started with that, just a little bit of description of what we were just talking about earlier.
Sure.
And see where that takes us.
So last week in West Virginia, there was the EPA Science Board and administration hosted a time to present testimony around the Clean Power Plan repeal. Just historically, the Clean Power Plan was something that President Obama put into place a few years ago, and the idea is to really reduce carbon pollution, primarily through power plants, which had never been regulated before. And so each state has its own opportunity to determine how they would reduce carbon. Maybe it's through nuclear energy, maybe it's through wind power, solar power, et cetera. And the reason behind the Clean Power Plan when it was developed was because decades of data show that carbon pollution can create all sorts of issues around respiratory disease, cardiovascular disease, myocardial infarctions, for example. And it also adds to climate change. So the more greenhouse gases, such as carbon dioxide, that accumulate, the less likely that heat can go back into the atmosphere. And it heats up the planet, and it creates a whole lot of changes in our climate. So the hurricanes, as a result, Category 5, as a result of the warmer water, et cetera. So the Clean Power Plan, the current administration is planning to repeal it. People may have heard that, they're going to get back the coal mining jobs, et cetera. The reality is that this data does not bear out. Interestingly, I attended the day last week where many people did provided testimony, including coal miners. Mm-hmm. And so the reality is that coal is a dying industry. There's no such thing as clean coal. And the job market around solar industry, for example, is expanding quite quickly. Mm-hmm. What's important for students to know is, since we're talking about climate and health, is some of the key pieces of information that tend to get clouded over when people begin to talk about the economy and jobs. Mm-hmm. The reality is that when we instituted the Clean Power Plan, the air did become cleaner. It's getting progressively cleaner. And with that, people are, one, more likely to be able to go to work because they're not sick with an asthma attack. Two, kids can go to school because they're not sick with asthma. And so not only productivity, but also the bottom line of our economy has actually improved as a result. It is predicted that there will be billions of dollars of savings every year if we continue with the Clean Power Plan. Thousands of deaths, hundreds of thousands of deaths are predicted if we repeal it. Also, healthcare costs will go up because we'll have more people who are sick because of the more polluted air. Mm-hmm. And so the Clean Power Plan is really important for students to get interested in. There's a comment period right now, and I think we can provide the link on the website.
Yeah,
you don't have to write a tome. You can put a couple sentences in of why you want the Clean Power Plan to stay intact. Mm-hmm. There were millions of comments under the last EPA administration, Gina McCarthy, and they were primarily in favor of the Clean Power Plan. It's discouraging that we're back to square one and getting comments again. So it's really important for people to appreciate that if they want to mitigate climate change, this is a key piece of the Paris Accord, what we promised, and that it will in fact support the health of Americans.
And I think one of the points that Laura brought up that's interesting, and it relates a little bit to Paul's work, is that as the temperatures get warmer and it gets rainier, we have more vector-borne diseases. We've already seen an increase in Lyme's disease and mosquitoes. We haven't seen a lot of Zika here in the United States yet. There's been some, but not a lot. And the Zika stuff is very problematic because, I don't know if you know this, but men who are exposed to Zika can keep it in their system for up to 6 months or so, and it can affect their female partners.
Yeah.
And so as it gets warmer and the days that the mosquitoes are out there are going to be longer, we're going to see more dengue, Zika, malaria, and all of these are tied to just warmer weather and wetter weather. I mean, even we know today it's the beginning of December, and we're all, it's quite warm outside. And it's much different than 20 years ago when we had snowstorms in D.C. We don't really have those anymore.
Yeah.
But with the warmer weather, pollen, asthma, these vector-borne diseases are all increasing here and in other parts of the country. So I think it's important that we think about what it means in our community and for Georgetown students, but also that we think globally in what it means for our brothers and sisters who live in some of these places. Laura and I were in California a couple weeks ago, and it was in the 90s in San Francisco, and we're seeing temperatures we've never seen before. So this extreme heat increases people's risk of heart disease, strokes, and as you can imagine, the very small people, the babies and the elderly are the ones who are most compromised. And all of these weather patterns, I think something that we don't think a lot about with health and climate change is what are the mental health implications for people who have lived through a hurricane, lived through a tornado, their house is destroyed, they're worried, they would like to have a child, or they're pregnant and they're worried about Zika. So these direct and indirect effects of climate definitely affect people's mental health as well.
Yeah.
One thing I want to add to the mental health issue, our center created a public service announcement, 30 seconds, and also something for health providers about the increased risk for domestic abuse and child abuse as a result of extreme weather events. So research has shown a six-fold increase in child abuse in kids 2 years old and younger, in head injuries. When there's either a wildfire or a flood or a hurricane, primarily with young families that feel disconnected with their community or don't feel they have anywhere to go. And so there's been a lot of research on post-traumatic stress disorder and depression post-Katrina and Sandy, but they're also looking at some of the more unlikely extreme weather events, such as the wildfires in California. And some of the mental health issues that go along with that.
To open back up just a little bit and pivot for a little bit on the vector discussion and looking at this in a global context, I think it'd be really interesting to hear your perspective, Paul, on just how vector-borne diseases have been sort of either increasing or staying stagnant, and just seeing a little bit of a look into that from your perspective, being an expert.
Sure. So that's a really good question. It's one of the first things that pops into people's head, I think, when you start thinking about climate change versus health, because and malaria gets a lot of the press, of course, but there's a lot of vector-borne diseases out there, mostly carried, the ones that are important for humans, mostly carried by one or more species of mosquito, but also ticks and some other arthropod vectors, tsetse flies, of course, in Africa for African sleeping sickness. So the major effect connecting infectious disease incidence and severity to human populations because of changes in climate is through the effects on the vector, the bugs that have to carry these diseases to humans. So there's several things going on simultaneously. It's true, it's not just temperature, it's also moisture, as was alluded to, because the development of these insects, both at the larval and adult stages, are dependent upon temperature and moisture, broadly speaking. And we're seeing two fundamentally important things happen, both spread of vector populations in altitude, so going higher up, where normally you haven't seen these diseases before, and then also spreading latitudinally, if that's the correct word. And there's been, you know, folks concerned about this for a long time, and a lot of modeling has gone on, and the data, you know, we're going to see this played out over the next 100 years or so, but yeah. The data starting to come in is pretty consistent with the modeling that's been done. So there's good articles out there. Students are particularly interested in where things are spreading to and how rapidly and all that sort of thing. But basically, further, you know, into the northern hemisphere, further into the southern hemisphere, and then higher up in altitudes.
Yeah.
And there's a variety of different implications depending on which region of the globe you're talking about and which disease you're talking about. The one that got a lot of press last year and the year before was Zika, of course. That was, my fundamental observation from following a lot of this stuff is that we basically just don't know anywhere near enough about the biology of these insects to fully appreciate what the heck is going to happen. Because there's simultaneous to just the spread of the established vector, meaning the vector that we know about. So for Zika, the predominant vector is a mosquito called Aedes aegypti.
Mm-hmm.
But it's known that related species like Aedes albopictus can also transmit Zika.
Mm-hmm.
And their geographic region is much further. They go all the way up to New York City and beyond, and they can survive in slightly cooler temperatures and so on. So as climate change continues to progress and we continue to see humidity, higher humidity, greater rainfall, warmer temperatures and so on, we're creating habitats where we not only promote the spread of vectors that we know transmit these diseases, but also are facilitating hopping of these disease pathogens to additional species.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing that particularly concerns a lot of us.
Yeah.
Lyme disease was mentioned. That's true. And we watched the incidence of Lyme disease as the Ixodes ticks geographic range has greatly increased in this country. Not all of that's due to climate change, but a lot of it is. The habitats are becoming
In the 20 years I've been a nurse practitioner, I probably in the first year or two maybe saw a case once a year in the D.C. area. I'm not talking about working rurally.
Yeah.
And, you know, now it's every week.
Yeah, yeah.
I had to show one of my Hispanic patients. I said, have you been in Rock Creek Park? Have you been any place where there might be deer? She's like, I've heard of a deer like Bambi, but I don't know what they look like. And I showed her a picture of a deer on the internet. And she says, no, I've never been in a park. I mean, she, you know, she didn't have, her history did not present itself in the way I went camping and I found a tick on me. I like to go hiking. And there was nothing. I mean, she lived in a very urban, densely populated area in Langley Park, Maryland, and Lyme disease. She didn't even know what a deer looked like. So I'm just, as a clinician, I'm seeing a lot more of that.
Yeah, it's an interesting, there's another, for Lyme disease, another really important host is actually a mouse.
Yeah.
The nymphs actually develop on the mice and then hop to the deer later on, and that's how they get transmitted to humans.
Yeah.
The adult develops on the deer, but the nymph develops on the mouse, so that's an obligate part of the life cycle.
Yeah.
And there again, you know, climate change is increasing the habitat of those mice and so on. So, and another important connection, I think, along with the temperature and the moisture is vegetation. So we've all noticed this. I've noticed it in my lawn anyway. New grasses that weren't there 5 or 10 years ago were popping up. And so there are certain types of vegetation that some of these insect vectors prefer to lay eggs upon and so on and so forth. So we're seeing a whole range of different factors contribute to the spread of these diseases.
I think the point regarding just seeing just more prevalence of these, especially in the clinical setting, is incredibly compelling, especially when you're going from not really seeing them ever, or like once a year or something like that.
Yeah.
How does that system work, like in making that shift to even know that that's something that you should look for?
That's a good point. And in the medical world, we talk about, you know, the differentials. What could it be? You come in with a sore throat. It could be virus. It could be strep throat. It could be, you know, something else. And we have to look at the way you present and what you're saying and then make our best judgment and based on the evidence. But it's pretty standard now when somebody comes in with vague complaints of you know, achy bones and being tired, like, in addition to other lab tests that we do, I mean, that's the presentation maybe of anemia too.
Yeah.
But as long as we're going to draw some blood, we draw many more Lyme titers than we did even 5 or 10 years ago.
Wow.
And some places it's just, you know, even if somebody has a bullseye rash and they pull off the tick, they're like, well, we could watch and wait. And if it wasn't on you for that long, we don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
And now the thinking is, which has other problems, but just go ahead and treat. And we don't want to overuse antibiotics, but people are so afraid of Lyme disease that somebody has a tick on them, we pretty much treat. I spend about some of my time in the summer as a medical director of a very outdoorsy camp in the Catoctin Mountains up by Camp David. We used to hear the helicopters when the Obamas were coming. That didn't happen last summer. But I guess Obama was still president last summer. But anyways. And, you know, there's a lot of deer and there's a lot of ticks, and every year there's a couple of campers who get treated for Lyme. And even in the years I've been doing that, we've seen an increase. And I think one of the points that Paul raised about the vegetation is really important. I know you talked about this last week, but food. I mean, really, it comes down to, can we safely grow food for all of us to eat? And many of the places in other parts of the world where there's been these huge famines because of drought, it's forced these migration patterns, you know, whole villagers are leaving, completely changing the economic structure because the climate is such that people can't grow their own food anymore.
I want to build on what Paul said about the vegetation as well, not only with vectors, but the plants themselves, right? So plants like ragweed, which can trigger asthma attacks and allergies, love carbon dioxide and love the heat. So what's happening is that they're growing bigger and faster. The allergenicity of the pollen is greater. And so we have several cycles. So the seasons are no longer what we would expect. I did some research a few years ago. There's literally 1 week in the whole year where there's no allergens in DC. 1 week. That's it. It's in January. And so what's happening is we're getting these warming trends, and then the quality of the air, we're getting plants to grow more. And like Paul said, different kinds of grasses, you know, so we've got the ragweed, and we also have poison ivy, which is a native plant. I was interviewed by the Post several years ago, and the writer's son kept getting hospitalized with poison ivy toxicity. And come to find out that he and his friend had gone through a field with his dog. Even though they kept treating his poison ivy, his dog had it. And the oils are so potent now that even one brush with it can cause serious problems, because the poison ivy plants, the leaves get bigger, the oils are stronger because of these climate changes. And so they had to actually look at the dog and treat the dog, clean it off his fur, the oils, because the dog would sleep with the kid, and then he would get reinfected. So there's all sorts of things going on that we may not even be aware of. You know, we may say, oh, is that tree blooming earlier? In fact, it is, but it's happening much more quickly than we expected as well.
And one of the things that we didn't mention with some of this is the increase in bacterial infections like salmonella in our food supply because of it being warmer. You know, diarrheal illnesses, which kill people in resource-poor countries.
Well, so that, bringing up diarrheal diseases, I mean, it's actually, when we talk about infectious diseases that kill people, malaria, TB, and HIV tend to get named, but the greatest killer on the planet are actually various forms of gastroenteritis caused by a variety of different viruses and bacteria. And those things spread much more rapidly in areas where there's poor sanitation and so on and so forth. So when we see these increased frequencies of floods and hurricanes and so on, you get standing pools of water in various places. It's been well documented. A couple of years ago in Pakistan, there was a huge outbreak. Haiti, of course.
Puerto Rico,
if we haven't seen it yet, we're going to. And when we just, you know, it's not just the temperature, or, you know, it's, there's a lot to do with ecological alterations of one sort or another that allow. So those are non-vector-borne diseases, but you're promoting these changes in weather patterns leading to, you know, standing pools of water more often than in the past, or giving us outbreaks of cholera and other things that we never used to see.
Everything that you guys are saying is just so compelling, listening to all the different things that are going on. And a lot of it almost seems like you can't even see it coming, right? I mean, things like the poison ivy, it's almost it's almost like, how do you anticipate that? And I think a lot of what we end up talking about in our episodes tries to drive a little bit towards So what can we do? What can we do as a community? We've got 120 really engaged students. What can students do to learn more about this, to be involved with this?
You're doing it now. I would stress education first and foremost, and carpe diem, and take control of what's going on. I find more and more often students, they tend to get almost intimidated by all the things going on out there.
Yeah.
This is certainly one of them, but that doesn't mean it's outside our control. It doesn't mean that you can't do anything. There's a lot you can do.
Yeah.
If you're particularly concerned about health consequences of climate change or, you know, at least vector-borne diseases, before you go anywhere, check the CDC webpage. It's usually very, very up to date.
Yeah.
There's a lot of information you can find there. If you go anywhere where any disease, you're at the peak season for transmission somewhere, and you come back, and you feel funny, make sure your doc knows where the hell you were.
Yeah.
You know, because a lot of times, it's a very serious problem. People, you know, get misdiagnosed all the time in this country because, you couldn't possibly have, African sleeping sickness for crying out loud. But
that's why we always teach our students to say, did you go on vacation recently? Did you go home to your country of origin? You know, tell me about it.
I mean, if you hear hoofbeats, don't think zebra, think horses, But then if you don't tell anybody about it.
Right.
but I also think, I mean, I don't mean to be trite for like young people, but I think there are a lot of lifestyle choices that people can decide to make. I mean, we've seen in the last month a huge increase in the number of shared bikes in DC now that we have the dockless bikes. Certainly, I'm sure every student on campus has Uber or Lyft on their phone, and there are times that for safety or for speed you might want to do that, but can, you know, what are some of the things that you can do in your own life to reduce, reuse, recycle, and be a friend to the environment? You know, plant a garden, shop at your farmer's market, talk to your parents about composting, think about buying, you know, none of us are pure, so I think about it when I go to a place and I come home and there's plastic. Everything's wrapped in plastic. Like I've just put all this food and it's all in all this additional plastic.
Yeah.
And so I think there are some things like that. And then Laura and I were talking about this a little bit the other day. As you may know, they've gotten the go-ahead to build a huge new hospital between St. Mary's, where our offices are, and in the existing hospital right on Reservoir Road.
Yeah.
And in general, hospitals are some of the biggest contributors to waste and greenhouse gases. I mean, a lot of chemicals are used, a lot of gases are used. If you've ever worked in a hospital, every time they open something up, it's in plastic. Everything's disposable. There's, you know, people don't know what an autoclave is anymore because you don't autoclave anything, you throw everything out. Lights are on 24/7. A lot of food waste happens. Air conditioning, you know, computers on. And so I would hope that the Georgetown community can talk about what we want to make this hospital a greener hospital. What kind of flooring do we want? You know, some flooring has you know, volatile compounds in it, which are bad for your health. What kind of lighting do you want? Could there be a green roof? Is there going to be, you know, what are they going to buy in their cafeteria? How are they going to do their food? And I think that when you're starting from scratch building a hospital, there is a lot of room, and it may be more expensive up front, but it's the right thing to do. And I think that we as the Georgetown community need to make sure that when they build another big hospital, and building projects themselves tend to produce a lot of waste, but that they think about some of the greening, you know, just even turning off lights and computers and, you know, having skylights to bring natural light in, which are, all those things are good for the human psyche as well as, you know, just health in general, health of the planet.
It was funny that you bring a lot of that up because I've always struck by these, to get on my political soapbox anyway, I'm always struck when I walk through Red Square, I forget which day of the week it is, Wednesdays or something like
this.
Is it Thursday?
The farmer's market?
The farmer's market?
Wednesday farmer's market. Yeah,
where there's all
Wednesday.
Of these delicious smells and you're starving and you walk through and there's all
you're
this
starving.
Food.
They and time it right at the right time.
right next to the ICC building with solar panels on the roof, there is the most far-reaching assortment of every meat, grilled meat dish that you can possibly imagine with one or two booths dedicated to vegetarian or vegan alternatives.
Thank you, Paul. You took the words right out of my mouth.
Well, and you know, everybody likes a good burger, I suppose, a lot of people do, but, you know, you see these huge grills of all of this meat, which, number one, is, you know, got awful unhealthy to begin with. I mean, once a week perhaps, but you know, nobody eats needs to eat as much meat as we eat in this country. And the damage to the environment from meat production and meat consumption is just unbelievable.
And the methane that the cattle produce is one of the primary greenhouse gases.
We tend not to think about methane when we talk about greenhouse gases, but it's arguably just as, well, I don't know what the numbers are, but it's up there with CO2.
Yeah.
And for a politically conscious, green conscious campus, it always strikes me this paradox between all of this meat and next to this solar panel building.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where are the damn vegetables is what I want to know.
Love it. That's brought up. The hyperlocals.
So Healthcare Without Harm is an international group, and it really looks at healthcare operations. And as Lois was saying, hospitals are second only to coal-fired plants in the amount of pollution they produce because they are on 24/7. And they do talk about eating, hospitals actually serving less meat, having farmers markets that have fresh produce available locally, and not just for the community, but for the people that work there. So so other things students can do. So eat less meat.
Yeah.
I grew up during the Jimmy Carter phase. Turn off the lights. Turn off your computer.
Wear a sweater.
Wear a sweater. Cuddle with your honey. Yeah. Whatever. But drive less, right? If you have to drive, you know, put your trips together. The other thing is, what is kind of circling back to where we started, is you really have to become politically involved. Mm-hmm. We get what we vote for, right? Mm-hmm. And if you don't vote, okay, you don't get the right to complain. We have a comment period open right now for the Clean Power Plan, which would be to mitigate or prevent carbon pollution.
Yeah.
If you don't comment and it gets repealed, then you don't really have any room to complain.
Yeah.
And so I think it's hard as students, because you're worried about getting A's and passing the exam. But you really, this is the time when you really need to cultivate sort of your civic responsibility. Yeah. And there are a lot of opportunities on campus. There's the Georgetown Climate Center out of the law school. Excellent website.
Mm-hmm.
There's a map there. You can click on your state and find out if your state has an adaptation plan.
Yeah.
And most states do not include health in their adaptation plan. They talk about flooding, how to become more resilient if there's flooding, but they really don't talk about health at all. So, get familiar with where you're at, what protections are in place or not, and you could be the voice that makes a change.
And I know we need to wrap it up soon, but I think an important point to that is that in the elections a month ago in November, there were 9 candidates across the state that were endorsed both by CASA of Maryland, which is an immigrant rights group that I've worked closely with, as well as by environmental groups, including Next Gen Climate Change.
Yeah.
And all 9 of those candidates won. And the reason why those candidates one was because of the youth vote, and there were people who went to George Mason and all the other universities and registered people to vote and got people engaged. And I think that we've clearly have seen how broken our system is and how poor our electorate is, in the sense that people just don't vote. They feel like it's not going to matter, it's not going to change a thing, or I'm busy. And we don't make it any easier in this country by having it on a Tuesday on a work day as opposed to Saturday and Sunday. Or, my city had early voting, but
God
not every place
a national
does that.
Holiday.
Exactly. But I think that there is no time like now for students to register and to cast their vote, because all of this stuff we're talking about is going to affect them and their children and their children's children and the future. And in fact, Laura and I have a colleague who is a 25, 26-year-old nurse who ran for mayor of Belfast, Maine, because she didn't like what the city was doing around environmental policies, and she ran against a guy who'd been mayor for 40 years, who was in his 70s, and she door knocked on every door, and she got people registered to vote, and she's a nurse, and she's now the mayor of Belfast, Maine, and climate change is, forefront on her agenda. Yeah. What can this community do? And I think that, especially given this administration, it's got to happen in the communities, because we don't have the political leadership in the White House to bring us there, so we have to do it locally, mm-hmm. and that's where I think students need to really be involved. You know, and if they're on campus, they might have to do absentee voting, or I would say register to vote in DC, but that's also problematic these days without being a state. But you know, our students come from all over the country, and their vote is their voice, and they need to use it more.
I think one of the interesting things to look at here is sort of understanding your own personal role in this, not just as sort of like an obligation, but thinking about how you can interact with this responsibly and considering your own health in these circumstances so that you don't burn yourself out through activism and thinking about these considerations responsibly. So I think it's compelling that we're listening to these things as well, but also thinking about students and how they interact with these issues and you know, I mean, how thinking about absentee voting, what resources are available, what students can do. So we meet them halfway. We want to make sure we don't burn our students out, but make sure that they're also engaged in everything they're doing. So that may be another point of topic, but I think it's compelling just to think about that.
Definitely. I found, for example, last week when I was in West Virginia, that when I'm surrounded by like-minded people, it's actually energizing. It's been difficult since January for those of us in the environmental community, and so it is for me personally helpful. There are things that get in the way, right? I mean, I have a job, and you know, I flippantly talked about getting an A and finals, which are real concerns. I've been there, you know, if you manage your time with other like-minded people, you'll find that you are going out to a bar, or you're going for lunch, and you're talking about these issues, and you're figuring out, you know, well, I can't do this, but I can do that. And because you can't be everywhere, and you can't be at every protest, and you can't call every day for whatever it is that's blowing up at the White House. So, you know, you have to pick and choose what it is, and protect yourself, do a little self-care, but also keep in mind that if you're surrounded by people who are like-minded, it actually can be very energizing. And you can say, you know what, Joe's going to do that tomorrow. I've got a final, but I can do the next one.
Absolutely.
I think just another little thing I'd throw in there for students that are interested in the topic, and I usually don't do this. I usually don't recommend books other than textbooks that I do want students to buy. But there's a great book that I picked up that I really loved when I first read it, by a fellow named Paul Hawken, H-A-W-K-E-N. He's a bit of a legend in environmental circles. And I can't remember the exact title, but it's something like Drawdown. Has this dramatic title, Drawdown and Solutions to Reverse Global Warming, or something like this. And like unlike a lot of other books, it's not this long, preachy, you know, whatever. It's just very practical, matter of fact, with, you know, some math and statistics to back it up. Simple things that any person can do, maybe sometimes groups of people, but very basic, very simple things, and how the rippling effect of, you know, millions of people, billions of people across the planet doing these simple things can indeed reverse climate change over, you know, the mid to long term. And so I think there's a lot of hopelessness associated with this issue. People throw up their hands and say, well, gee whiz, it's a global problem. It's so huge. You know, how do you get fossil fuels? What can I do about this? There's actually a huge amount that individual people can do, and very, very surprising things that you wouldn't normally think of. It's not just about burning stuff and driving less and all that stuff, but I remember reading that one of the more impactful things really has more to do with political action than any kind of environmentalism or conservative. It basically has to do with educating women. We don't, you know, worldwide, if more women were educated. I mean, sometimes it's a little bit, you know, you have to follow the connections, connect the dots sort of thing. But it's a fantastic read, actually, just to open your mind up to the various possibilities, the day-to-day things that even small groups of people can do to have a huge impact. So don't throw up your hands. Get engaged and read and learn, and you'd be surprised what's possible out there.
And find something you're passionate about. I mean, somebody may be passionate about biking, and somebody else gardening, and somebody else, you know, doing a water project in a developing country, but it's got to be something that you're passionate about to take it to the next level. And I think regardless of what students are studying at Georgetown, there is room to talk about climate change in any of these professions.
Yep. That's right.
Even English literature. I mean, just the descriptions of the countryside then and what we see in the countryside now, especially with, today's news that he wants to take some of the public lands away in Utah, was it?
He did it.
He did it.
2 million acres. Sorry.
But one way that people can rejuvenate, I think, is just spending time in the outdoors. We've worked a little bit with a pediatrician in D.C. who has a park prescription program where he prescribes time outdoors for his patients. It's good for their physical health. It's good for their mental health. And he believes that it once you fall in love with the outdoors, you'll want to be an advocate for it.
Yeah, no,
and it certainly is a good way to... as they say in Spanish, to recharge the batteries.
Yeah, no, absolutely. In the interest of time, I'm gonna bring us to a close here and just see if there are any final comments the group wants to offer up. This has been incredible in hearing all of your different perspectives, and especially thinking about some of these action items are pretty compelling to hear too, especially the hospital. I mean, for my entire time engaging with global health, I had never thought about hospitals being the number two contributor towards carbon emissions. So that's pretty shocking.
Yeah, and I don't know if they're planning on using any green products in their,
This is good.
So your very first question talks about consensus on the relationship between climate and health. And 97% of scientists believe that climate change is human-caused.
Yeah.
And we get more and more research. EPA in 2016 and I think this year they got it through the White House, have a report on climate and health. And you can go on the website and you can see all the things we talked about. So universities are about evidence and science, right? Science is there, despite whatever you might hear in the news. So I think that's really, really important for folks to keep in mind. If it doesn't sound right, it probably isn't. It's probably just noise.
Yeah, we didn't really get into all of the details, but among your other questions, have we seen any disease patterns altered in the United States? We touched on Lyme a little bit. What diseases will be on the rise because of climate change globally? That's actually a pretty long list and a substantial list. And again, that's all science-based. These things are happening. And we've touched upon some of the, simpler things that are a little less lethal in this country. But worldwide, the death toll from climate change is, I hate to be overly strident, but it's potentially catastrophic in certain countries. And not only the human cost, but the economic cost that goes along with that when you start losing. So malaria, for example, kills primarily children under the age of five. And so there's an economic cost along with this that aside from the human cost that's absolutely terrible. And we are already seeing this past year I'm upset to cite is the first year in a long time where we've seen malaria mortality actually increase. There was a slight uptick in the last year. So all of the gains that we've made over the last 20 years we're starting to lose, and there's some complex reasons for that. It's not just climate change, but climate change increasing the incidence of the disease certainly does not help the situation at all.
And I think last but not least is that health is the hook. So I've been doing this for, 15 years, and people care about their health, their kids' health, their grandkids' health. They don't care about the polar bears. I do, but most people don't. It seems distant, not connected. But when you start talking locally about what those issues are for that region, what the health issues are, people begin to listen. And so if students are really wanting to make a change, start with health, because people will listen.
And healthcare providers need to talk about these issues with patients, but also with their policymakers and their colleagues.
All right, fantastic. Thank you all
Good.
So much
Thank
for
you.
Coming.